Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Thanks for listening on Friday, November 1st, 2013, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. We start the program, as we always do on Fridays, with the Federal News Countdown, and this week's experts choosing the three most important federal news stories of the week. Jenny Mattingly of Shaw, Bransford & Roth, it's great to see you, my friend.
Hello, good to be here.
Thank you for coming in. And Dan Chanuk of the IBM Center for the Business of Government. And this is like three times in one week that we've seen each other, because
absolutely,
we ran
Francis.
Into each other a bunch of times at ELC. I want to congratulate you and your colleagues that are involved with ACT-IAC for putting on just a terrific conference down there. It was
great.
Well,
thank you, Francis. It was great to see you there, and you were a terrific part of the event.
Well, thank you. We did a webcast on Monday in between the tracks and the evening session, and I enjoyed hosting that, and I would be happy to do it again anytime they'll have me back if I didn't bust the camera.
All right. We'll look forward to seeing you.
I would be glad to do it. We're going to start the countdown where we always do with...
Number three!
Jenny, your third most important federal news story of the week is headlined, After Government Shutdown, Few Discussing Budget Options. It's from the Huffington Post. And the gist of this essentially is similar to a story we have on federalnewsradio.com, which is... We would think that we would see some action now because the clock is ticking toward January 15th. And yet, other than just a meeting where they've given opening statements and then everybody went home, we've seen nothing out of the conference committee yet.
Well, and I think it was always going to take a little while for them to get up and running and figure out where things are going on. A lot of it's behind closed doors. But one of the things, when I first saw this article, I thought, okay, this is all about the conference committee, about them talking. And it went on, sure, it talks a little bit about what Congress is going to do, but it's also talking about what they're saying out in the states, too. So part of the problem we keep running into is, sure, they're doing work up here on Capitol Hill, but what they're saying out and about, that's driving a lot of how people feel they need to behave on Capitol Hill and what positions they need to take.
The story says that it talks about some of the positions of some of the issues or some of the people that are involved with this, but it also takes a look at some of the people that may be involved with this before too long. The story says, in Georgia this month, Democrat Michelle Nunn, a U.S. Senate hopeful, blasted the shutdown deal. Congress's short-term deal sets up for yet another potential shutdown, and wrote in an op-ed, neither side has been serious about making the hard choices necessary to reduce the national debt. And I thought that comment and the fact that the writer here chose to focus on that was interesting for a couple of reasons. One of them is because Michelle Nunn knows her way around Washington, because her dad was Senator Sam Nunn,
right,
for about 500 years from Georgia, and one of the most well-respected members of the Senate of the 20th century. And also because she voiced there what I'm sure you've heard from a lot of the people you deal with in the federal government, which is, this doesn't help me out at all, because I may be back in the same situation January 16th if they don't come to a deal this next time around.
Well, and that's what everybody's afraid of.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, and I was looking at the calendar today. There's something like 19 legislative days when they come back.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really impossible to do that much with big issues.
Well, and the other thing that's significant about this, and this story touches on it, is they've already decided this isn't going to be about big issues. This is just going to be about eking something out for the rest of fiscal 2014, and then that's going to be the end of it. And then hopefully, thankfully, maybe we'll get back to regular order by the end of this fiscal year for 2015.
Right. But we don't even know if they can do that. And with what you're seeing people start to say in the states, who knows if they can actually get something done.
Jenny Mattingly's third most important federal news story of the week is from the Huffington Post via the Associated Press. After government shutdown, few discussing budget solutions. Dan Chanuk, your third most important federal news story of the week, speaking of ELC, is from Information Week. It's our friend Wyatt Cash's story about remarks by Steve Van Rokel at ELC on Tuesday. And I have to say, I was struck by the comments that I was not able to stay for Steve's speech on Tuesday, but my colleague Jason Miller covered it as well, and he points out some of the same things that Wyatt writes about in his story. I understand that you want, when you're in a situation that is uncomfortable, to put the best face on that situation that you can. But I was struck by reading Wyatt's piece in the same way that I was listening to Jason's coverage on my program Tuesday afternoon, when Steve said that the launch of healthcare.gov was something to be proud of, and that just That just struck me as odd. I agree with what he said about this being a teachable moment, because these are the same lessons that I think you and I have talked about these lessons before. But this just struck me as that might be maybe painting a bit overly optimistic face on it.
Yeah, I think when he was talking about that, and I chose the story more for his future orientation rather than his comments around the launch of the healthcare.gov site. But I think he was talking about the goal of the site and the what he used the term boldness of the approach rather than the implementation of the site in terms of his feeling of something to be proud of. And I think what he was – when he used the term teachable moment, it was more about moving toward the idea of government procurement and buying and building systems in a modular way that's agile, where you can innovate and prototype and then build from that, which is consistent with commercial best practice. It's not something that the government procurement system is very good at.
Mm-hmm. Do you get a sense that despite some of the problems with healthcare.gov in maybe programs that are lower profile, that that's starting to happen? Do you hear that happening?
I think agencies are asking how they can do it. If you look at the Presidential Innovation Fellows program and the initiatives there, those are done in this model. If you look at some of the activities around the Open Data Initiative, which is the current incarnation of the Open Government Agenda from the first term, you see some action going on around consolidating buying patterns around use of open interfaces and taking advantage of reusable components rather than building things from scratch. But it's going to take a long time. It's taking us a long time to get to the procurement system we've got, and it's a matter of finding examples in agencies and innovations that you can build from.
As a sidelight, I think it's a good opportunity to highlight things like the Presidential Innovation Fellows. I was on a program last night where one of the other guests mentioned them and was not familiar with them, and I was glad to be able to explain that these are not folks who are coming in. These aren't interns. These are people who right. are veterans of the doing the same kinds of projects in the mm-hmm. private sector, who are here for this specific purpose, to help government understand private industry best practices and how they apply in really difficult situations inside right. the federal government.
And I think you're seeing some of them, although I don't know the details, go over to help with the healthcare.gov reforms and try to make the improvements in the website that will go on for the next month or so.
So let's focus on the future look the same way that Steve did in his speech. He says, the key thing we're here to ask is, what can we learn from this? What do you think the one or two most important things are that we can learn from this in IT development?
So one lesson is, make sure that you've got your team together and testing together as they roll out implementations prior to launch. So there were 55 contractors. Many of them had never really worked together before, other than through some sort of happenstance coming together in various ways. So that's why in the hearing you saw them say our application worked, but the end-to-end testing wasn't done and that sort of thing. So both from a technical perspective in terms of doing the end-to-end testing, and also from a management and government governance perspective, getting people together around the common goal and having a regular cadence where those people are working toward a goal, where they do rollouts and do beta tests. Those are two of the significant lessons, I think, from this launch.
Dan Chanik's third most important federal news story of the week is from Information Week. It's Wyatt Cash's story headline, Federal CIO Urges Bold Vision for Government IT. You can read it and all of the stories on this week's countdown posted later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Second most important federal news story of the week is selected by Dan Chanik and by Jenny Mattingly when we return on this week's Federal News Countdown in just a moment. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Dan Chenick and Jenny Mattingly, and we are at
number two.
Jenny, your second most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec. The headline is, Acting IRS Chief Bemoans Travel and Training Cuts. And this pertains, of course, to the acting commissioner at IRS, Danny Werfel. But I imagine he's probably not the only person in the government that's upset about the fact that they can't do travel and training to build their workforces at this point.
Right. We're hearing this a lot because you start seeing is this, you know, we've had an executive order that's cut down on travel budgets and training budgets, and we're starting to hear this from both employees and agencies. How do you train people? How do you make sure they have the right knowledge? And then I think the shutdown, in my mind, the shutdown really crystallized this. When you have people filling in, sending them home, doing different jobs. You want to make sure that you are investing in your people, that they know how to do their work, and that they have the skills to do it. And I think we're going to start seeing this erosion of people having the necessary certification and skills to handle what's coming down the pipeline.
Dan, Danny focuses on something here that I've heard from a number of different people on all sides of the ideological spectrum, agency, industry, Congress, and everybody. There's a danger that the pendulum will swing back too much of the way. He was talking about the reaction to the conference spending scandals that we've heard of from a number of different agencies over the past couple of years. He may be behind the curve on the comment, because it appears that, at least from the reaction of some people in Congress, they're ready for this pendulum to swing to the side of don't go anywhere, don't spend any money on training if you can possibly avoid it.
So it's interesting, even this week at the IAC Executive Leadership Conference that you mentioned, we saw some agencies be fine with their people traveling and getting a lot out of interactions with their peers in government and industry. And other agencies were very much, no, we need to be very strict on this. And it's often correlated with the attention that they get from the IG or from the Congress. So it becomes, it's almost like politics take over the training function, which is, as Jenny said, is really not what you want. You want to have a strong level of training across. I think Danny is pointing this out very well, and it's appropriate that he did this at a program that recognized, you know, outstanding federal employees who presumably and leaders who have gone through and been supportive of training in a lot of different areas.
Mm-hmm. The awards that Dan's referring to, the Roger W. Jones Award for Executive Leadership given by the American University School of Public Affairs, and I know that some of the awardees here, including David Bray, the Chief Information Officer at the FCC, have been on this program, ironically enough, Jenny, talking about these very issues. How do we continue to develop a workforce that is going to be productive and is going to do the things that Congress demands of it as budgets get tighter and people are expected to either do more with less or do the same with less, or hopefully the recognition will come that we're going to have to do less if we have less.
Right. And we've been talking about that for years. I mean, we've had legislation that I've worked on through Senior Executives Association, other management groups, trying to get mandatory training, because agencies always have cut it when budgets are tight. This is not new, but this is the worst I've ever seen it, where everybody is afraid. That's part of why I thought this story was interesting, because it's coming from the IRS, who has had their fair share of scandals. And here they are finally talking out, talking back about why they need this and why we have to be really careful about public perception versus reality of needing to be trained.
Well, and there's also a significance here, I think, Dan, that it's the commissioner, although he's the acting commissioner, the commissioner, the head of the agency, is saying this is important, not just the HR department or managers at a lower level. This is the top guy at the agency saying this is important and we need to stake out this ground.
Well, remember, Danny's career is built on a lot of training and experience that he's had as an SES candidate through his tenure at OMB, where I had the good fortune to work with him, and through his time as the OMB Deputy Director for Management, essentially in practice, mm-hmm. although he didn't carry that title as an acting until the very end. And he basically saw and oversaw a lot of the federal government's human capital initiatives. So he came to the IRS with an appreciation, both from his own experience and from overseeing a lot of programs, about the importance of this. And he's trying to bring that sensitivity, I think, to this issue.
Jenny Mattingly, second most important federal news story of the week is from GovExec. The headline is Acting IRS Chief Bemoans Travel and Training Cuts. And it's posted later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Dan, your second most important story of the week is from FCW. It's Mark Rockwell's story, headline, Procurement Officials Explain New Normal to Contractors. And this is from Wednesday's Coalition for Government Procurement Fall Conference. Frank Kendall spoke at this event, among others. Kathleen Turco, the Chief Financial Officer at VA, present at this event. And the phrase new normal gets thrown around a lot, especially in the last year or so, based on where we are. And defining what the normal part is of what we've experienced can be tricky. What is your sense of what new normal means in the procurement area right now?
Well, we've had 20 years or so of CRs as a fact of life, continuing resolutions. And oftentimes, early in that history, agencies could wait and do a lot of their procurement in the second half of the year, and they'd have enough time and enough certainty. Over time, and especially in the last few years, that time period has been shrunk, And the amount of resources that agencies have both been uncertain because of sequestration and given to them late in the year and shrinking as well. So contracting officers who have waited to basically implement contract processes till the end of the year are, rather than take that as the normal, what this is saying is you should plan during the year for, you may have a little bit at the end, but you're going to have a constrained amount all the way through. So you need to practice and prepare with your offices that are doing the buying for this to be the reality all year long and make adjustments.
Frank Kendall said he was preparing for a long siege by cutting back on new research and development contracts, stretching out existing R&D contracts, and expecting a decrease in force readiness. Jenny, it sounds like we're getting at the things we're robbing Peter to pay Paul to some degree. We're by cutting R&D and force readiness that we may need 5 years from now to meet the budget demands of today, and that's fine for today. But when you get eventually, we're going to get to 5 years from now,
right? And then what do?
Yeah,
you all of a sudden you don't have the people in place, and that goes back to the training. It goes with IT. It goes with pretty much every part of what we're talking about that's getting cut across the board with sequestration. Is you may save the dollars now, but you're not going to have the right resources 5 years from now. But on the flip side, and I've seen it in some agencies, there are areas where you could do procurement reform and change some of the practices that you're doing that would save dollars that are good practices regardless of what the budget situation is. So the hope is that some of this forces those mechanisms into place.
And I think to Jenny's point, agencies that take the conversation we had earlier about let's look at a smart IT implementation, mm-hmm. like modular and scalable, that can apply to any procurement.
Absolutely.
That can make your dollars stretch a lot further. Whatever you're buying, whether it's a service, a technology, or even a product to some extent, you can buy small, try it, adapt it to your environment, and then you can spend the amount of money you have, whatever that amount of money is, more wisely, as opposed to cutting at the top
yep.
and indiscriminately cutting and basically doing things the same way.
But this is all dependent on some movement from the people, Jenny, that you deal with on a daily basis, which are our 535 best friends on Capitol Hill.
That's right.
Figuring out how, regardless of what the document looks like that they come out with, and that's a discussion for somebody else, eventually these agencies need a roadmap of some sort, which they haven't had, as you said, Dan, for God only knows how long.
Well, but that's part of the question. I see people starting to talk about fallback positions mm-hmm. in Congress. If they don't get a budget, what's their fallback? And some of that is giving agencies the flexibility to manage sequestration dollars. A lot of it's driven by appropriations authorizations where agencies have to spend in certain areas. But if you give agencies the ability to be flexible with their budgets, are they able to implement some good practices and save money at the same time without it being a, you know, this blunt tool of cuts?
With all due respect to my friends at the agencies who I have a tremendous amount of respect for, that's a cop-out though, isn't it, Dan? I mean, that's the job of Congress is to provide an appropriations budget for agencies to follow. That's the way the Constitution works.
Well, that's part of the new normal, is that given the situation that we have now with Congress being unable, and it, you know, it's not just the last few years. People don't remember that it really has been this way for a while.
Yeah.
It just hasn't been, the degree is getting worse
mm-hmm.
Now because of the political elements that are at play in Capitol Hill and between Congress and the administration. So the idea of this piece and trying to say that, all right, given the reality of what we've got, let's understand how we can work best as a government working with industry in terms of the contract relationship between companies and agencies. How do we make that work best to deliver value to the taxpayer as best we can given the reality?
Dan Chenick's second most important federal news story of the week is from FCW. It is under the headline, Procurement Officials Explain New Normal to Contractors, and you can read it and all of the stories on this week's Federal News Countdown when later this afternoon at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back on the Federal News Countdown, the most important stories of the week, as selected by Jenny Mattingly of Shaw Bransford & Roth and Dan Chenick, the IBM Center for the Business of Government. We'll be right back. We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week. It's selected by Jenny Mattingly of Shaw Bransford & Roth and Dan Chenick of the IBM Center for the Business of Government. And we are
number one.
at the top of the chart. And the number one most important federal news story of the week is selected by Jenny Mattingly, is from Bloomberg. The headline is budget deficit in U.S. narrows to five-year low on record revenue. And the lead in the story says it all, Jenny. The U.S. posted its smallest budget deficit in 5 years as employment gains helped propel revenue to a record. What I read between the lines there is, if the economy takes off even just a little bit more and the job picture starts to look a little bit better, still not great, if it starts to look a little bit better, our deficit problem certainly isn't going to go away anytime soon. But it's going to change dramatically, and it has the potential to change dramatically pretty quickly.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you go farther in the story, you see the word, but what you don't see right at front is sequestration.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't necessarily the cuts. It wasn't, you know, whether Congress kept the government open or not. But a lot of what this is going on was all economy. We went through an economic depression or a downturn, you know, and that's what drove a lot of the deficit. I mean, there were a lot of drivers to the deficit, don't get me wrong, but that making these big budget changes within a downturn, I don't know if that's always the best way to, you know, it was a short-term fix that's now having big-term ramifications, but the economy is still growing despite what they did with sequestration. So does this give us, you know, my hope, obviously, from my opinion, is let's look at this and say, wait, can we get rid of sequestration and still start going up?
Now, one paragraph in this story, Dan, sums up the difference people ask me about all the time, which is, what's Washington like now compared to how it used to be? And they're always referring to the tenor of debate on Capitol Hill. This story says the mandatory cuts don't touch benefit payments to programs like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Many Republicans want to replace the automatic cuts with reductions in spending on these entitlement programs. Democrats, including Obama, have indicated they're open to some of those ideas as long as they're paired with new tax revenue, which Republicans oppose. Now, maybe I'm dating myself, but it seems to me in the old days, especially the pre-90s days, we would go, we would see the smoke-filled room, and we'd come out with a deal that had a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and everybody would say, I don't like this, but I did, you know, because it contains this and that that I don't like. But that usually was the sign of something reasonable. And that's the part of it that I don't think we see anymore. Is that observation fair to you?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think the smoke-filled room has been replaced by the tower of social media to some extent.
Because but that's not necessarily a good thing,
well,
I don't think.
It has its benefits and it has its drawbacks. It's hard for members to go into the room and talk and come to a deal in a space of quiet essence, if you will, where they can kind of come and then come out and say, you know, we have the resolution, and then work with each of their sides to basically rally the votes to support that resolution. Because there's so much discussion and chatter among all of their constituents, which then gets magnified to either side. And I think back to Jenny's point about growth being the imperative, and I think you do hear both all sides talking about growth as the imperative and different ways to make that tactical. And even in the administration, one of the elements of the president's management agenda is how can the government generate growth from its activities. So it all goes to the fact that, as this article points out, growth is really the number one driver in terms of deficit reduction. As the administration has pointed out, it's down by half. You know, as the congressional leadership will point out, it's not down by enough. So, how, you know, can you reach a deal?
When you get to the crux of this, though, as I did in that one, in the paragraph that I pulled, there's room to give if everybody gives a little, and somebody's going to have to be. Somebody, I think, has the potential to score a lot of points, Jenny, if they're the first person to say, "I'm willing to give this up that has been my sacred cow, a little bit. I'll give 10%." Of the direction that they want me to come, not 100, but I'll at least start it. Neither side's willing to start right now.
Well, the funny thing is there are people on both sides who that's the way they'd like to function. Hmm. That's how they always did. You know, you go back to your smoke-filled room where
yeah.
you each give a little bit and it's messy, but nobody watches it and there it is. But there are a bunch of groups, and because it is out in social media, nobody's willing to start that, and nobody's willing. What they hear from people immediately is, you caved because they hear instant feedback.
Yeah.
And so you don't have a chance to actually message, explain why before all of a sudden you have to backpedal. So nobody wants to go down that road. So I find it, I hope that they will eventually come to some grand bargain, but I find it really difficult to see how the two sides are going to actually step across that line or stop their staring contest.
And in addition, each side will say that they already have given. right? Right. The president will say, well, we accepted the smaller number.
Yeah.
And the Republicans will say, well, we accepted the tax increase in 2011. And they're not giving
okay,
each other
credit.
Okay, but that
was credit. 2011.
I understand. But they're,
it's 2013.
People
wait a minute,
still remember
let me look.
It, though.
Not, but it's not like people are acknowledging yeah. that as the start of a process of
right.
give and take. Hopefully the discussion, and I'll talk about it when we talk about the last piece, mm-hmm. we can continue the discussion because hopefully we'll get there.
Yeah, the give, though, is the difference that I see today, the lack of it.
And there is a lack of it. Nobody's yeah. willing to make that step. And I don't see it's the same players talking about the same issues that we've been talking about for the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
How do we change?
Are we heartened at all by the fact that we do have at least have the conference committee that we talked about earlier in the program? I mean, is that a reason for optimism at all?
So I think if you put Congressman Ryan and Senator Murray in the smoke-filled room, I actually divorced from the external pressures, I think they could probably come to an agreement that
uh-huh.
just about everybody, you know, or except for a few folks on the outside, would be supportive of. But as Jenny said, it's really the room to have that discussion is very, very fine grained, and they have to thread a needle every day in how they talk to each other.
I didn't hear the opening statements at the conference committee meeting the other day, Jenny, but I did hear Senator Murray and Congressman Ryan talking about the fact that they were going to conference the day after the shutdown ended. And Senator Murray pointed to Congressman Ryan and said, he knows I'm not going to vote for his budget, and I know he's not going to vote for my budget. And I was at least heartened by the fact that they were standing next to each other talking about the fact, and Congressman Ryan said something to the same effect.
Right. They don't agree, and they both all – one good thing is everybody's staked out a position. We know exactly where everybody stands right now, but – that's also a problem because if you've staked out your position, then how do you move past that? Because mm-hmm. you've put it out there very clearly. I actually am in favor of just locking everybody in a room, throwing away the key and saying you cannot go home until we will not let you out. We will not feed you.
When you fax out a deal.
Yeah, this right. is the white smoke option.
That's
right. That's right.
I want to see that.
Keep them there, man. Jenny Mattingly's most important federal news story of the week is from Bloomberg. The headline is budget deficit in U.S. narrows to 5-year low on record revenue. And that story and all of our federal news countdown stories this week, as selected by Jenny Mattingly and Dan Chenick, are linked up later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Dan's selection for the most important federal news story of the week wraps up the Federal News Countdown next on In Depth with Francis Rose. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected this week by Jenny Mattingly of Shaw, Bransford & Roth and Dan Chenick of the IBM Center for the Business of Government. And we wrap this week's countdown with Dan Chenick's selection as the most important federal news story of the week. And Dan, you make my colleague Jack Moore very happy by selecting his story headlined, Will New Budget Negotiations Unravel the Sequestration Riddle? And I have to brag on Jack because this is a terrific story and I appreciate you recognizing this. It includes a chart of the funding levels under all of the various scenarios that we see now. So we have a really good sense from Jack's story on what this will look like and not just words on the page or on the screen. But what this really gets down to is kind of what we talked about in the last segment, which is there's space between just slapping something together to fix fiscal 2014 and this grand bargain that people think is still a ways off. There is potential for these people involved in this negotiation process to do something about sequestration, which I haven't been able to identify a single human in the city that thinks that it's a good idea, Dan.
Well, I think that's right. But one of the things this chart shows is that it's a $92 billion issue, and that in most negotiations at this level, budget negotiations, the sides have been able to come together, and whether it's $46 billion, which is exactly halfway, or something like that, they've been able to come to a result. Even with sequestration remaining in place, as we were talking about earlier, more flexibility to the agencies to manage that. And that was the other thing I thought was interesting about this article, was it talked about how agencies are managing and what are the ways, in addition to the contract issue we talked about earlier, what are the ways that agency program leaders can manage their programs in light of uncertain amounts, given the likely result that at best, there'll be some sort of a flexibility in exchange for some level that's reasonably close to 967, even if it's not exact.
The what you're getting at is Jack puts it this way. It's a quote from Sharon Parrott, Vice President for Budget Policy and Economic Opportunity at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, about halfway through the story. Part of the problem, this is Ms. Parrott from the center, part of the problem is that what was supposed to happen and what has actually happened aren't the same. Budget Control Act was supposed to impact civilian spending and DOD spending equally, and that's not what we saw in the final deal. And it kind of takes me back to what we talked about in the last segment, kind of talked our way around, Jenny, which is Congress can do whatever they want. They can make the finished product anything. They're not stuck to these numbers that are here or the law as it's written now or whatever, because they can just change it.
Well, that's the funny. I mean, Congress has the power to make whatever laws they want to make,
right,
within constitutional constraints here. But it's funny because people are acting like it's either no sequestration, full sequestration, and they're stuck to these numbers, and this is where they have to start. They could, if they wanted, go back to the pick a number, go for it. And I did see something today where Mikulski and Hal Rogers, you know, the appropriators here, were asking for a top line number so mm-hmm. they could start trying to work some of this out. But, you know, I think people need to step back from sequestration a little bit, the members of Congress, and say, okay, you know, if none of us want sequestration or it's not playing out the way we want, what is our end game? What are our goals? And how do we get there? But mm-hmm. I think that conversation, again, has to be removed from everything else that's going on.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, Dan, if the way that Senator Mikulski and Congressman Rogers want to approach this isn't the best way to do it. I know it's not regular order where you ask for the top line first and work the details out. But given where we are, maybe that's not such a bad idea.
Well, anything that will bring together members of Congress of goodwill in a process that they can build out from, like whether it's the 12 senators who worked on the deal previously, or, you know, there's going to be several signposts along the way as we go through. December 13th, critical, mm-hmm. as the committee, basically the conference issues its report on that date. That's a full month before the funding runs out, and Congress has to make a decision about whether to keep the government open. One thing I would say on that point is that the decision to keep the government open, anytime we've had a CR in the past, that same threat has been there. It's just that you, in the past, except for 1996, which I had the good fortune of living through, in the past, you didn't have long shutdowns. Uh-huh. So people understood that the goal was to reach an end result. And I think you're hearing most members, including the leadership, say they don't want to have another shutdown. And so really we're then coming into another issue of how do you resolve this and how does it relate to something we haven't talked about on the show yet, which is the debt ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
And then, again, how do managers operate under that environment as a constant cloud that's sort of over all of their and our heads as they go forward?
One of the things that we may see out of this, the shutdown that has already occurred, and maybe you can have a sense of this from being on the Hill all the time, Jenny. My understanding is that one member of the Republican conference, I don't know who it was, went to a meeting of the group of members that were all wild about stopping the Affordable Care Act, defunding it, and they were the holdouts, and said, listen, had you not been so insistent on that, healthcare.gov would have been the number one story in every newscast from October 1st until today instead of from October 17th until today. And if that's your goal, you'd be farther along toward that goal. So if you would just shut up and sit down and let the people who have been here before do this, you'd have a different result, a lot closer to what you want than what you have now. And I wonder if that sequence of events might not lead us to a situation where the more experienced hands, as we get to December 13th and then toward January 15th, might have a little more control this time around. Does that scenario make sense as you hear it explained that way, Jenny?
I mean, it does, and I think that's playing out. You hear quotes across the board of people who have been around for a long time saying, you need to stop. Mm. You know, this is not helping anybody. And in fact, a lot of Republican members have said this has hurt the Republican Party. So if your goal is to get reelected or goal to do it, you know, you've tanked in the polls. But I think there's a new paradigm with some of these folks, because the message still is that I'm hearing on the Hill from some holdouts, we have goals. We were sent here to do this. Our goal is to defund Obamacare or to stop the administration. And so the problem is when you have people who that is their goal. Their goal was never to balance the budget. It was not to, you know, or that's not their primary goal. And, you know, I think it's just a whole different way of looking at things in a different paradigm of doing work. And it only takes one person in the Senate mm-hmm. to block things, regardless of what the issue is or which party it's from. So if you don't have everybody on board, you still run into the same problem.
Yeah. But Dan, do you take any comfort in the fact that maybe the adults in the room, the experienced hands, might have a little more power this time around?
Well, I'm hopeful.
You're a glass half full guy.
Absolutely.
So good
absolutely.
On you.
Thanks to my parents for that. I think that the government itself, the vast federal program and service operation that serves citizens every day in many ways, defense, transportation, student financial aid, does not operate at either end of the political spectrum. And so the pressure will be because all of those people, the benefits were shut off in many different ways. For 2 weeks, people were worried about paychecks and lots of different impacts, that pressure will be enough to cause people to come together in a way. As we approach December 13th, I think that'll be the first sign. If you see we're working together, we're trying to work through it, we may need a few more days, we're rolling up our sleeves, et cetera, as opposed to, you know, we're just not talking and it's just before Christmas, mm-hmm. then I think you'll see sort of a tendency one way or the other.
So in other words, it's just a little too early to tell in your view?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're just not good at the waiting game in this town, though, Dan. You know that. The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Dan Chenick as Jack Moore's story on federalnewsradio.com. And Jack writes later in this piece that it really does come down to the tax increases versus the spending cuts. And I just go back to what I was talking about earlier, and that is it seems so close and yet so far is kind of the sentiment that I have as I look at this. I mean, do you hear that at all on the Hill, Jenny, or aside from the folks who are, as Secretary Rumsfeld would have called them, the dead enders?
Right. Well, you know, I think people quietly are talking about how they can get there. I don't think anybody's ready to really talk about it. And then you've got the House on recess right now until after Veterans Day. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a little bit of a waiting game for most people on the Hill as well. And the way most big legislation has played out over the past year, it's leadership offices. It's not your rank and file members. And so a lot of them feel left out of the process. And so until I think some of those guys start putting pressure, and you saw it a little bit at the end of the shutdown where several members of the House started saying, you know, we need to come to a deal, we need to end the shutdown, you know, but until some of those guys get a little louder and say, we want to be involved and this is how we want to see it go, I think it's going to be hard to get that sense until you have those big deadlines mm-hmm. of where people are actually yeah. going to come together.
And the staff work can be done leading up to that. But as Jenny said, human nature works on deadlines mm-hmm. often. And a deadline is a forcing function to make a decision. And that's why I think really you're going to see a lot of sort of lower level discussions in the next month. And federal employees and agencies need to basically be able to live with that. And then hopefully see some progress in early mid-December.
And you anticipated exactly where I was going to go next. If we go through this quiet time, this waiting game, that's not a reason to get nervous. That's maybe a reason to take some comfort that this might turn out okay this time around.
I don't know that I'd use the word comfort. I'm not that half full of a glass person.
It's only half full.
But I think it's smart planning uh-huh. and understanding. Let's say you can be fairly confident that you'll at least have the sequester level,
yes.
right? So if you plan for that and understand that if you're planning for the year, that's the level of spending you'll have. And then if you get more, you can always adjust up. That's a more prudent mechanism.
The 967 number?
Yeah, then starting at the 1050, the 1.058 trillion yeah. number and then working down. So really kind of think about planning for the year and then making adjustments as more money might come in based on a deal.
I do think it's a good idea that we're hearing from the Pentagon and from the other agencies that they're already planning based on the 967 number. And then if they get to January and they have more, they won't have to do it the way that they did it this year, which mm-hmm. was they got to the sequester and right. where some of the agencies didn't have any money left, hardly.
Right. And the flexibility will help with that as well. Right. Hopefully that'll be part of the
and
deal.
And it's always easy to add on than it is to cut
yes.
things off.
Yes, it's always better to find a 20 than
That's
to lose
right.
it, right? The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Dan Chenick. On the Federal News Countdown is my colleague Jack Moore's terrific story. I'm a little biased, but it's a great story. Headlined, Will New Budget Negotiations Unravel the Sequester Riddle? And it's posted now and on federalnewsradio.com. And all the stories on the Countdown today will be up later today on the in-depth page at federalnewsradio.com. Guys, a terrific Countdown as always. Dan Chenick, great to see you again. And Jenny, you too. Thank you for coming in on this week's Federal News Countdown. The stories are archived and our conversation archived later today too at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. And the next hour of In-Depth with Frances Rose is right around the corner.